say I have a face for radio, and it's a joke that, like, it's, oh, I have a face for radio. And but, like, that's the thing, is that anybody can have a face for radio because nobody can see.
Exactly.
I think I have the wrong mic on for you. Can you
say? La, la, la. Hello, Mike.
That's good. Okay. Yeah, we're
John.
Back.
John.
John.
And
Mike.
Dave. And Mike.
Yeah. We have all kinds of names. We should actually name these.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this one seems like a Stanley.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We need, across the street at Kmart, they have, like, metallic Sharpies.
Yeah.
So you could, like, write in gold Sharpie, Stanley on the bass.
On the bass. Then the problem really becomes, though, is that the basses might get mixed up.
We won't
remember which one.
That would be terrible.
We'd hate to, like, misname our microphone.
Well, you could name the microphone, like, right there on the edge.
I can talk to Nick God and see if he'd be okay with that. I don't think he'll bite, though.
Dang.
Don't think he'll bite.
Oh, well.
I'm looking at the IRC channel. Mad Joe, our wonderful friend of the station, he says he has a face made for radio, but a voice made for print.
Oh,
Mad Joe, I don't know. I don't agree with that at all. All right, so I'm here with Alicia. This is apparently her third time on Radio Statler.
Yep.
I guess we must like you because we keep inviting you back.
Either that or you don't have anything else to fill your hours.
Oh, that's
but
not true. That's not true. We love having you on. You always talk about great stuff.
I love being on. And I always bring Worried Monkey, too, although he doesn't have a voice for radio because he has no voice. But, you know,
yeah,
he does like hanging out by the mics.
I mean, that works. Whatever makes him happy, that's fine.
Wait, actually, I should take a picture of him by the mic right
now.
You
should,
just
yeah.
And tweet it, you know, because that's important.
Twitter is very important.
Twitter and Worried Monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got to keep...
He has his own Twitter account, at Worried Monk.
At Worried Monk. At Worried Monk. You heard it here. Now's the time to subscribe. At Worried Monk on Twitter.com.
Yeah. So, I'm not sure where Joel is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, which is a little disappointing. I was, because you guys are both working together on that workshop.
Yeah. So, we're only streaming, right? We're not...
There's no video.
No, I mean, we're not on air. We're just streaming.
We're streaming on the internet. There is no
FCC.
There's no FCC here. You can say all seven of the words you're not supposed to say on radio, because this isn't really actually the radio.
Excellent.
Except for briefly when Radio Wonderland was playing earlier this morning, in which case that was actually radio. But, like, that doesn't count.
That, okay.
Well, because it's music.
So, Autocorrect insists on calling this Radio Starlet. I just thought I'd... mention that.
I once posted or created a title for something that was Radio Stapler. And instead of, I think it was a YouTube video, and instead of correcting the title, I changed the description to say that it was a podcast about, you know, office supplies. Everything you could possibly want to know about paper clips and printer paper.
Absolutely.
Mad Joe says, welcome, and to drop as many F-bombs as you like.
Yes, so we were talking about...
You're talking about your workshop.
Yes, Assholes and Infiltrators.
Okay.
So I've got to say, I'm rather disappointed with the fact that whoever put the titles of the workshops into the brochure...
Yeah, what did they put it as?
They put it as something like... A role-playing game for counterintelligence or something like that.
Here,
and
we
it's
actually
like,
we have the over on the other end. It's probably, how far can I go? How far can I? Oh, God. All right. Let's look at the workshops. Talks. Love that you can actually hear me turning
the
pages.
It's
really
for
adds
real.
That authenticity. Speakers. Is workshops at the end?
It's close to the end.
Oh, my God.
It's
kind of
down at
go.
The bottom. And it was on Saturday at noon in Budapest.
Ah. a role-playing counterintelligence game for activists and hackers.
Yes, yes. But the title that I gave it in my proposal was actually based on the title, well, it, actually the name that we called it at Standing Rock, which is Assholes and Infiltrators.
Okay.
And I also wrote an article for Gods and Radicals.
Okay.
Godsandradicals.org. Just a plug for that.
Yeah, plug as much as you like.
But I wrote an article for Gods and Radicals called Assholes and Infiltrators also, okay. Which basically describes the same sort of things that we were covering in the workshop of when you're involved in a movement like this, you... you start to look at everybody else and every stupid thing that they do, you're like, oh shoot, is that person an infiltrator?
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it happened to me. There were people who were like saying that I was an infiltrator because it took a month to get the internet working, which was quite frustrating to everybody, including myself. But I mean, there were lots of good reasons, but of course, if you don't know those reasons, it's like, well, clearly she's trying to
sabotage
or whatever.
We can't get the,
But I mean, even organizers, like lead organizers of the movement were being, you know, people were talking behind their back going, are you sure that person isn't an infiltrator? And, you know, somewhere, I think it was like late November, early December, I was sitting in the tech tent and, you know, once again, for the bajillionth time, somebody was like, do you think so-and-so is an infiltrator? And I was like, no, no, not an infiltrator, just an asshole. And and then that became like, oh, wait a second. You know, really, if you think about it, if you think about all these different times that we're going like, is this person an infiltrator? If you contemplate it, you realize, no, no, this person is just an asshole. Because every single one of us has our trauma, our personal agendas, our little, you know, pet things that we're after. And the fact of the matter is, every single one of us is going to do something that damages the movement that we care about, whatever that movement is. At some point in time, we're going to do something stupid. And doing something stupid or doing something damaging is not necessarily, like, you know, I mean, it's problematic, but it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, and it certainly isn't a key to say, well, this person is an infiltrator.
I mean, people make mistakes all the time. It's just part of being a person.
And there are some people who will make lots of, you know, mistakes, do lots of things that are very infiltrator-like, and they aren't infiltrators. They're just real assholes. And so, you know, part of what we started to kind of talk about in the tech group was how do you manage the people who are problematic? Because it doesn't matter whether this person is really an infiltrator or just has a major mental health issue.
Yeah.
You know, if they're causing lots of division, they're causing problems. They're going to break us up. If there was one guy, I'm not going to mention his name, but he definitely has some major mental health issues. And he spent some time working with construction.
Mm-hmm.
He spent some time working in my team. He spent some time working in the emergency shelter. He was just like bouncing from one place to another.
Yeah.
And every place he went, he was talking about how the people at the last place he was were horrible people and did all sorts of awful things.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you know, causing these wedges between different people. And, you know, I was pretty sure that the reason he was doing this was purely mental health while we were there. And I didn't know how to deal with him. You know, I went and I talked to John Bigelow, who is the head of the media team and was also kind of helping run the emergency shelter before Joel became the head of the emergency shelter. And was like, what do we do with this guy? And Joel actually has a lot more experience with dealing with infiltrators because he actually used to be an infiltrator. was like, no, what we're going to do is we're just going to keep him away from people that he can cause troubles with. And we're just going to make him go be busy in the corner. So he like gave him some construction work to do at the Cannonball Rec Center. And that kept the guy busy and out of trouble until eventually he left. So was he an infiltrator? Maybe he was. And, you know, in the end, it didn't really matter because as long as we could control like, not control him, but control the potential damage that he could do.
Yeah.
That was what mattered. And as Joel likes to point out, if there is somebody who's an infiltrator who's getting paid by somebody, if that person is not able to bring information to their employers and they're not able to actually cause the division and the problems that they're supposed to be causing, if you've managed to quarantine them successfully, then their employers are going to pull them out.
Yeah.
So, you know, you win. They've licked some stamps in order to send some mail, or they've, you know, built a tiny house in the backyard or whatever the heck it was that you guys needed that person to do while staying clearly out of trouble. And then they got pulled out of there because they weren't giving the information that their employers wanted. So, yeah.
So, so the workshop is really teaching people how to more manage problematic individuals, or is it have an aspect of like identifying if somebody might be an asshole or an infiltrator?
Both of
those things?
Yeah, so the way that we kind of planned the workshop was that there was a game that was based on Mafia. If you don't know what the game Mafia is, it's also called Vampire, it's also called Werewolf, but if you look up Mafia game on Wikipedia, there's actually a whole Wikipedia page on this game that includes like the mathematical analysis of how you win the game and things like that. So we did an adjusted version of that game.
Okay.
In part, what I wanted to get across in the game was the fact that if you traitor jacket somebody who's innocent, that it causes more damage than the infiltration itself. Because when you traitor jacket somebody who's not actually a traitor, then you've A, lost that person and whatever they brought to the table, but you also potentially are causing new splits, which is exactly what real infiltrators wanted you to do in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? So, so showing how easy it is to pick the wrong person and say, this person, in our game, it's hackers and cops.
Okay.
So, you know, just because I wanted a good metaphor for hope. so, you know, if you say, well, this person is the cop, and it turns out that they're not, well, now you've just removed a person from your team that would have been helping you move forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we had a whole day to play this game and just, like, really throw ourselves into it, we could have put some more wrinkles to actually make it, you know, even more practical in terms of, you know, trying things out and whatnot. But instead, what we did was we would run a round of the game. So a round of the game is a day and a night.
Okay.
So we'd run a round of the game, and then we'd discuss kind of what happened and what that means and relates to real world situations. And then we run another round of the game, and then we discuss some more. And then at the end, you know, rather than completing the whole game the way that you normally would, we just had the cops raise their hand so that everybody could see who the real cops were.
Yeah.
And then we spent like the last 10 or 15 minutes letting the cops talk about, you know, what their strategy was for keeping from getting caught. Because in the whole game, during the workshop, only one cop got caught.
Really?
And everybody else that got, you know, lynched, according to the wording of the original game, everybody was an innocent who got traitor jacketed.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. And that's actually a lot like real life.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult thing to do, right?
Right.
Are there any tricks or insights that you've gained or are teaching people when you're going through this game?
So, I think the number one thing that I think is important is don't declare that somebody is an infiltrator unless you have absolute positive evidence and you can corroborate it with, you know, preferably more than just one other person, right? So that it's not just one person standing up and saying this is definitely an infiltrator. You've got several people, because if it's just you and you've got proof but nobody else has seen the proof, for one thing, that infiltrator can turn on you and then try to say, no, you're the infiltrator. And that creates a whole other mess, right? So you need to have corroboration, and you need to have real solid proof. If you don't have that, then what you want to do is you want to find ways to isolate the person, not in the sense of like totally socially isolating a person and making them feel like an outcast, but in the sense of make sure that you're not giving them information that you don't need to give them. And really, this is good OPSEC in general, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of those things. We hackers, we talk about OPSEC, and we get all into that. But, you know, activists and movements, a lot of times they'll talk about OPSEC and then be like, oh my God, this is just too much work.
Yeah.
And then, or they'll just start having a friendship with somebody, and then they'll just like spill their guts. Oh yeah, there was that one time when I sabotaged the railroad and, you know, or whatever,
yeah.
You know, like I'm just making stuff up. I'm just, so then now they've just given somebody all this information. Well, the thing is that one of the things that real infiltrators will do is they will try to make friends very quickly and build deep rapport as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So, if you feel like you're comfortable enough to spill your guts at somebody, maybe don't.
Yeah.
Maybe don't. If you know them because of the movement, whatever movement you're in, or you know them because of your hacker crew, whatever hacker crew you're in, maybe don't spill your guts to that person. Be very careful and very cautious. So this is a total tangent, but this actually kind of makes me think about one of the problems that hackers and activists who actually care about OPSEC have, which is, you know, for your mental health, who do you talk to? Who can you trust?
Yeah.
Right? this is one of the issues that Frontline Wellness United is kind of here for, to make sure that there's mental health professionals who actually understand the issues and problems of operational security for you know, whistleblowers and activists, but there are some really good conference talks. If you just like go to YouTube and you know, type in like hacker mental health, there's actually a bunch of really great conference talks about how to figure out who you can talk to, and also how to talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist about like, okay, I, for real, it's not that I'm paranoid, like it's not that I'm pathologically paranoid, it's that I'm professionally paranoid, and I really need you to put your telephone in this Faraday cage.
Right? Like, just leave, you know, lock the phone in the car, just leave it there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one thing as the person who's coming to a care provider to say something like that, like, I'm leaving my phone in the car.
But
then you've got your care provider, and when you say to your care provider, so I see you have a Google Home device. You please...
I would hope that there are no professional psychologists or psychiatrists that have smart devices.
You would be surprised.
Oh, no.
Yes, and Siri turned on, and their Google, you know, the Google search, the voice search on their phone turned on, and their computer set, like Cortana on their Windows computer sitting on their desk, and, you know, I mean, all sorts of things like that. I've actually... in the last year, I've had so many conversations with healthcare providers about exactly this issue. And when I bring it up, they're like, that's an issue. That's a problem. Like, they have no concept having that stuff in their office where they're,
I mean, that's
treating patients. They have no concept that that's a problem.
It's a huge issue. I would think that, like, because whatever you say, like, with your psychiatrist is strictly between you and them. That's giving it to a third party. That's terrible.
That is. Like, oh, but they don't even, most of them don't realize that that is basically what they're doing. They just don't even realize. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's Standing Rock. Again, tangentially, but still kind of related. At Standing Rock, we had an issue where people's phones were going missing for a day and then suddenly showing up in like on top of their bag or whatever like that, right? There were a lot of phone hacking incidents of various sorts. But there was a rash of them among the mental health care providers. And, you know, when I finally found out about it, because I kind of found out about it late, when I found out about it and started kind of like trying to figure out what was going on, these mental health providers were like, but I don't understand. Why would they want to hack my phone? And I'm like, are you kidding? Everybody is telling you their secrets.
Oh my God. So along with your workshop, you also, have you already had your talk?
Yeah, Friday morning at 10 a.m.
Oh, so like you pretty much opened.
Yeah. It was like, good morning, my eyes are almost open, please give me mate.
How did it go?
It went pretty well. I did feel, I'm not much of a morning person. And of course, this is Eastern time, and I'm kind of a West Coast girl, so it's like early morning. And so I'm a little bit concerned that I may have been stupider than I would have been if I'd been on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But people seemed to like it.
It's usually a good sign.
Yeah, I managed to get through it with only a few minor embarrassing moments. I dropped my phone, and then the alarm on my phone went off, and I picked it up, and I tried to save myself by cracking a joke about the president, but whatever.
We have one question from IRC. They say, would you think that Mycroft is safer as a background Siri or Cortana for therapists to have in their office, or are we screwed with these online services?
We're screwed with all the online services. If it can hear, then...
If it can hear and send it to the internet, period, then you're already screwed.
Right, right. There shouldn't be any recording devices.
No.
I mean, think about it. Like,
even locally, you shouldn't have it. You should just not do that. That's a huge liability. Why would you even take that risk?
Yes, I know. Well, I mean, think about this. Just imagine yourself, oh, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, if you knew that there was a bug in your psychiatrist's office or your psychologist's office or like your gynecologist's office or whatever,
like,
right?
Literally any office.
Right. And somebody said there's a bug in that office, you would have felt really, really uncomfortable and been like, who's been listening to everything I'm talking about? Even if you didn't have an interesting threat model. But, you know, today we've got bugs everywhere.
Yeah.
And we've just invited them into our homes and into our doctor's offices, and oh my gosh.
Oh, we really messed up.
We did. This is why I'm a Luddite. I'm not a Luddite in the sense that most people think of, like that you're afraid of technology or that you don't know about technology, obviously, because...
Yeah, you just know too much about technology.
Right. I'm a Luddite in the sense that... I really don't like the idea that we're handing over our humanity to our technology, and we're also allowing technology to be used against us. It's being used against us by the state. It's being used against us by capitalists. It's being used against us by, you know, by everybody but us. And that's why open source is so important.
Yeah,
because it puts the power back into our own hands to choose how to use the technology. And to be users of technology instead of be used by the technology.
I think it's one thing that makes it difficult and probably why such things like Google Home and all that stuff are very popular is because people don't necessarily see that it's... like, they don't understand the attack because it's very high level and, like, you don't necessarily... You can't necessarily look at, I got a Google Home and now I have this weird advertising. And, like, you don't necessarily put that together... Because it's kind of far removed.
It seems to me like people put it together for moments and then decide that they're not going to worry about it. Because it's just, it's too big, it's too many things to worry about. And the conveniences. I mean, the conveniences are so convenient.
It's always the problem, isn't it?
Right? I mean, it is. It's nice to be able to take my phone and just talk to my phone, and it gives me the answers to something, you know?
Yeah.
It's so convenient. Not just convenient, but I mean, I'm a geek. I was a geeky kid. I always wanted to be able to just talk to the computer on my spaceship. Well, I don't have a spaceship, but I can just talk to my computer, and that's pretty damn cool.
It's very
so,
cool.
Yeah, it is. It's really damn cool. But then, it you know, when you realize, as a grown-up geek, that being able to just talk to your computer like that comes with some consequences, it's like, oh. And I don't know what the long-term solution to that is. Like, mm-hmm. how do we take... Because the power to be able to process that much, you know, real language, real human language, and to actually be able to have answers and things like that, how would you do that without having a big company behind it? Like, at some point, I mean, the power of the computers will be small enough and you know... The memory will be cheap enough and whatever.
Yeah, eventually stuff maybe can be, but right now it's hard. It's very expensive to do like natural language processing.
Exactly.
It's a technically complex problem.
Exactly. So really, right now we've kind of run ahead of ourselves. It's kind of like we're third graders who've discovered calculus and are very, very excited about calculus, but we don't really know what the hell we're doing with it.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
You know, or like a high schooler who's discovered genetics and is now trying to reinvent the dinosaur. And like, we as humanity at this moment, we have enough knowledge to be really dangerous, and we don't necessarily care enough about the fact that we're harming ourselves. And there's so many different reasons. Like, there's the, it's exciting and I just want to do this, because it is. It's like,
you know. It's the reckless teenage years of humanity.
Yes. This is the reckless teenage years of humanity. I love that. But then there's also, like, the capitalist side of things, we can make money off of this. We've got to get it to market as fast as possible, because money, profit, and money.
Move fast, break things.
Move fast,
don't care about what you're breaking, but just break them.
let's break the climate. That's no big deal. We could totally fix it.
Oh.
Sad face.
I was reading Billions and Billions by Carl Sagan. Recently. Mm-hmm. Have you read that?
I haven't.
You should probably go pick it up if you haven't.
I should.
It was published in like the late 90s, and they're talking about, so like if you contrast, I think it's CFCs, the hole in the ozone.
And
where
thing.
The world kind of came together, and it's like we have a problem, the world kind of came together, and they mostly solved it. Like it's been healing kind of. Like, it's been okay. I think there's one person that recently that's, like, started... Like, nobody knows who it is, but they've started making the chemical again. So it's decreasing at the rate that we're expecting it to. But, like, just seeing that and then also seeing discussions, like, from the late 90s that are... It's like, now hopefully we can do the same thing with global warming, and then seeing how that's played out in, like, the past 20 years has been...
Yeah.
Really sad.
It really sad. And one of the things that's so frustrating about that to me is that it's not that there's no answer, it's not that there's no solution, it's that we're, like, really, as a society, we're choosing not to work on the solutions. We're getting stuck on having controversies over straws. Plastic straws.
Yeah.
And we're not dealing with pipelines. We'd rather argue about straws.
Straws are easy to argue about.
Are you serious? Right. Like the actual damage that's happening to the planet is happening mostly, I mean, just overwhelmingly from the industrial side of things, not from the consumer side of things. So when we control for these little consumer things, okay, yes, it does make some tiny impact.
But it's not the big rocks.
It's not the... Right. It's if we want to fix the big thing, we have to deal with the corporate stuff, the industrial stuff. And, you know, for some countries... China, I'm talking about you. the state stuff.
Yeah.
And if we don't deal with that, those massive problems, all these like straws really aren't going to matter.
Yeah.
And we can solve our power problems with small scale renewables.
Yeah.
We can solve our problems with heterogeneous solutions. Everything in our society right now is all about doing everything at scale. You have to make it big. It has to be at scale. Well, you know what? We do not clothe an entire city in one single t-shirt. We actually make t-shirts so that every single person in the city can wear a t-shirt and underwear and pants.
Distributed clothing.
Well, just imagine if we did distributed power. Yeah. Wow.
What a difference that could possibly make.
It really could, because what works to create local power in Arizona is different from what works to create local power in North Dakota.
Yeah.
So I actually was talking about this yesterday with somebody. Mark Ruffalo, bless his heart, donated a massive solar trailer with, you know, solar panels and, you know, batteries.
Yeah,
and
wow.
The whole nine yards for Standing Rock, this really, really massive thing. Mm-hmm. And when it showed up, I was like, did he not talk to anybody about what the environment actually is here? Because
probably not.
Because this is North Dakota and we need power in the winter, and all of those solar panels are going to be covered in snow.
Yeah.
And we're kind of far north, so we're going to have very short days. And what we really need is windmills. And windmills aren't that expensive. Like, everybody thinks windmills like the massive things, right? You can get a windmill for $250.
Yeah.
And, you know, we built mini grids at Standing Rock that provided lights. I mean, our lights were LED Christmas lights. That was what we lit our tents with. But but we were able to light several tents at a time with a mini grid and a single windmill. And that windmill worked day and night, and it was the appropriate thing for that environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, that big, huge solar system, it's not that it didn't work at all. It just didn't provide as much as it could have for the same amount of money.
Yeah. It's a resource, you know, allocation issue.
Exactly. And that's why it's really important to actually be aware of where you're putting whatever it is you're putting, whatever solution. You have to make sure that your solution is actually fitting to the environment.
Yeah.
And digging up fossil fuels, I do not think, is appropriate solution to any of our environments. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would agree with you that it's not the most effective, or especially at this point where, like, you have many, like, especially for things, not, it's, natural gas would still be a fossil fuel, right?
It is. Now,
so, like, if you look at fracking, like, the environmental damage that fracking does in comparison to, like, you, like, come on. There's right. better things we can be doing than...
So yeah. Here's something that actually kind of boggles my mind, and maybe somebody who knows more about energy could, like, explain why this is. But why the heck are we... digging up or pumping out natural gas when we've got sewer systems full of methane that could be captured? I mean, yeah. This really is a thing. Like, on farms, on off-grid farms, it's been a thing for a very long time to have a biodigester to handle not just the human waste, but
yeah.
also the cows and,
the waste,
you know,
from the
waste from the livestock.
Yeah.
You put everything into the biodigester. It produces methane. You use that methane for all of your gas appliances. And it, you know, it's basically a...
Should be relatively carbon neutral at that point, right?
Exactly.
Because it's being produced by humans and cows that have removed it from the environment, and then it gets re-released later, and then...
Right. It's kind of like the difference between... You know, burning coal versus burning wood. When yeah. you're burning wood that was sourced locally, so you're not adding lots of, you know, miles to the wood, you're putting carbon into the air that was just in the air a little while ago, yeah. right? Whereas when you're burning the coal, you're putting carbon into the air that was in the air a long time ago.
Yeah, it's been missing for a while.
For a while.
and wasn't as nice back a long time ago as right. it is now.
Well, you know, and the thing is that we also have to mitigate, you know, not just mitigate, but reciprocity. This is a word that gets used a lot within sort of the spiritual communities that I'm involved with. But reciprocity is really key. It's not just that you cut down the tree and burn the wood, but also
you should
that
probably
you're,
put a new tree back, right?
Yeah, putting a new tree back, or you don't cut the whole tree down. Yeah. You're just cutting parts of the tree so that the tree actually continues to grow more healthfully. You know, you don't just, you know, monoculture everything. You grow things so that they're in relationship with each other, like the three sisters, beans yeah. and squash and corn, just as an example. It's the yeah. most famous example. But, you know, all these different things that we can do so that we're actually living in reciprocity with, you know, the planet we live on, that really every single molecule in your body came out of something yeah. on this planet. It's in totally scientific terms. You are this planet. This planet is you.
Yeah.
So you should take care of it.
Definitely agreed with that. So it's about 6 o'clock. I'm not sure if our next guest is here. I've asked on the Slack to see if that person is here. But is there anything that you really, really want to talk about? So your panel went very, very well.
Panel went well. I mean, the workshop went well.
I mean, yeah,
the
workshop, talk, sorry.
Yeah, the talk went well. The talk, I've done previous talks mm-hmm. about, you know, what happened at Standing Rock. And if somebody's interested in sort of like the broader story of what happened at Standing Rock, it's really easy to find the talks from Linux Fest Northwest. Again, it's on YouTube, Linux Fest Northwest, Leisha Sterling, 2017. There's two talks, one on bringing internet to Achitishakuing, and another talk on the security issues at Standing Rock, which you might find interesting. But here, the talk that I gave, more of the focus was on what do you need to do? What lessons did we learn about building more networks? Mm-hmm. And for people that are here in New York, we're going to be having a mesh network get-together tonight.
Oh, really?
We're meeting here at the mezzanine at 8, but then we're going to go somewhere. I don't know where all we're going to go. Like, I've been told that we're going to decide together where we're going to head to from here. But we're basically going to have a get-together with a bunch of people that are involved in mesh networks across different places in North America. And I think it's really important for us to be building more community networks, both in, you know, relatively wealthy places like cities, but also especially in rural areas, which yeah. are not well taken care of in the United States.
They really aren't.
And also, you know, my current my current big concern is making sure that the Native American reservations that are here in North America actually have decent access to internet. The Walker River, Nevada. The Walker River Paiute Reservation in mm-hmm. Nevada, they have high-speed fiber that goes straight through their reservation. There is no access to any of that fiber. And the only internet that you can get on the reservation is dial-up.
That's no good.
That's got to change.
If they have the fiber there,
that's
got to
change,
should.
Right?
Yeah. So, God, I mean, you gotta at least let them have a drop off of that to like
right?
go build stuff.
Right, exactly. So, you know, that's just one example of many. And I know that, you know, it's easy to say, well, internet is the least of the problems of, you know, Paiute and Diné and Lakota communities that often don't even have access to clean water. If you just look, again, look on the internet for videos of water on American reservations, and you'll see lots and lots of examples of water that you would not want to bathe in, much less drink.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, honestly, getting internet to these communities is a low-hanging fruit. It's not that difficult.
Yeah.
You know, we need some resources in terms of money and in terms of people who are able to come and teach the locals how to build and how to maintain their own network. And having real high-speed internet in their communities will help them to build the economic strength to be able to take care of their own water systems and whatnot. So, you know, it's certainly not the most important thing in the whole wide world, but it's definitely something we can do to make things better.